The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to stock picking guru John Heumann of Vox Markets to knock around some investment ideas today on the fixed income space and the tech sector. So welcome, John.
Hello, Paul. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. In fact, probably a lot better than Jerome Powell, because the big news overnight was that the Wall Street largely ignored what the Federal Reserve said in terms of increasing interest rates by 25 basis points to just over 4.5%. And likewise, the markets have also ripped today, both bond and the equity side, even though the Bank of England's increased interest rates by 0.5% and the ECB done likewise. So putting all that together, how should sort of like smart investors now interpret the data? Are we going to get a soft landing? Is this a bull market, or are we either going to have a bear market rally?
I mean, you know that I'm generally more on the cautious side of things. it's true. I mean, the central banks, particularly the Fed, are struggling to get their message across, to put it kindly. Really, it's as clear as mud what the outlook is there. I'm not convinced. I look across the economy, and I know that you shouldn't look at the economy as a proxy for the stock market, but you know, things don't look good. I was looking at tech, which we're going to talk about today. Layoffs across that sector are massive. You know, there is a big reset going on in the sector, and on the basis that tech sort of drove everything for many years, growth drove everything for many years, up to and then it sort of accelerated it into and through the pandemic. You know, the idea that the tech industry can be weak and everything else can be fine doesn't stack up to me.
Yeah, and the other thing which doesn't sort of stack up, I mean, I know it's probably a well-trodden cliche, but obviously a lot of investors sort of say, look at the fixed income space for sort of good clues, because they seem to get a good idea of
the bond market leads. You know, the smartest guys in the room.
So on that basis, I just cannot get my head around a near vertically sort of sloping or inverted sloping yield curve in the States. And it's 70 basis points between the twos and the tens at the moment, which I think has been a very reliable predictor of recessions. I mean, what's your view?
Well, the recession is coming. I mean, it has to be coming. And there's various factors which I think are sort of staving it off. But, you know, we're seeing some horrible data here. We're seeing horrible data in Europe, Germany in particular. Germany's really been powered by the strength of China. China, yeah, it's reopened, but, you know, we're not going back to what we were. Away from tech, we're seeing real softness in automotive. We're seeing softness in housing markets. I tweeted something today. I mean, it's really anecdotal, but a house that was being sold and was almost sold on the open market for $250, in a really sort of little village here, eventually went to auction a month later for $150. There are real signs of pressure in the economy. But then you go out, I went into Norwich city centre just after Christmas, packed. Queues for Wagamama. And I must admit, I'm struggling to read the economy from what I see around me, from the data I see. I think it's really hard to say what's happening here. So I think, perhaps even more than ever, the stock market is becoming somewhat detached from the reality of what's on the ground, even though that reality is hard to read. But if you can't read what's on the ground, then how can you possibly say whether we're sort of X months ahead of an economic recovery that would justify what we're seeing on the stock market?
Yeah. I mean, it seems as though a lot of the sort of the consumers are still spending the last pennies they've got from the savings, et cetera. And that's why I've had a decent Christmas. And even more so, it has been the consumer spend out in the States and stuff. So that's sort of prolonging the sort of the weak or subdued growth, and we haven't sort of tipped into negative GDP tofu, but that's only got a certain set legs. And I'm getting worried actually about the 2024 estimates for sort of corporate, because we've got a low one for this year, probably $200 per share on the S&P, but they're currently breaking in sort of $245 or $250 per share for the next year, significantly increased. And even on that sort of 240, we're still at 18 times, you know, PE for the which seems pretty much stretched. And so on that basis, if we are going to get sort of like a recession, I think you and I are on the same page. What is, in terms of the inflation, I mean, one of the sort of like the big things, even if inflation rolls down, is that could be just a red herring. It doesn't matter, because even if inflation does come down, we're still not going to avoid effectively economic damage.
No. Well, I think the economic damage is already happening. You know, and again, I keep coming back to it, you know, the housing market and construction, because that underpins so much of the sort of the feelings of strength that you get in an economy. You know, where you've got weak housing markets, you know, the rest will inevitably follow downwards. So I am worried. You know, as you say, looking further ahead, that we're not really seeing the pain yet. You remember we had two Christmases as well that were essentially cancelled by the pandemic. So, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, wanted a last hurrah. I don't think people were prepared
in Wagamama.
Okay, fair point. No, seriously, it was insane. I think a lot of the problems you have actually in the retail sector and the services sector in the UK, services sector in particular, actually are exacerbated by labor shortages. So this is something we hear about a lot, that actually, you know, there are so many vacancies which suggests, you know, economic strength. But those vacancies are also, you know, they're a double-edged sword. So if you're in the hospitality industry, if you're running a restaurant and you can't get staff, you can't serve people. So you can go in a restaurant where you've, you know, struggled to book a table and see the place half empty. And it's not because there aren't seats, it's because there aren't people to serve you and people to cook food. So, yeah. You know, and that's inflationary. Inflationary. So I'm not sure, you know, yeah, we're seeing some moderation of those who are headline figures as things like oil and gas retreat, energy prices retreat, you know, food prices retreat. They're all connected. But the wage side of things, I'm not convinced. And, you know, we are seeing, you know, negative wage growth at the moment in real terms. People are getting, you know, their spending power is disappearing. And they might not be feeling it now, and they might want that last hurrah at Christmas. But I'm absolutely, and actually, people want to go on holiday. That's the other thing. So you've seen some real strength in sectors like travel and leisure, because people are just, you know, that's the thing they've been missing. That's where the money's going, you know, out of retail, into you know, consumer services, because people have missed it. So yeah. And again, it's that sort of inflationary on the services side of things. We saw some inflation figures from Spain, which suggested that, you know, it wasn't dissipating as quickly as some had suggested.
Yeah, no, I think the price of a San Miguel had gone through the roof, hadn't it? So I think you and I are on the same page. It's going to be sort of like tougher for longer in terms of the economic backdrop. And in that basis, let's just sort of like, you know, pick through, turn the sort of, you know, the gears into the sort of fixed income space, because now we've got unprecedented interest rates, particularly in the sort of short term, sort of like over 4.5% in the US, increasing in the UK to a peak probably around about 4.5%. In Europe, it's going to go over 3% as well, which is unprecedented since the great financial crisis. So nobody's seen it on that basis. So just more broadly for investors, because they probably haven't really ever looked at it, what are the sort of like the key advantages traditionally of fixed income? Because I know last year they were all correlated, the same assets and bonds, but if you buy a sort of like a bond, I won't put it yet, what sort of advantages do you see in terms of the fixed income space?
I mean, you know, the traditional thinking, you know, yeah, modern portfolio theory was, you know, your sort of 60-40 equities, yeah, bonds. You know, you move into your sort of risky, riskless, risk-free, lower risk assets, bonds. You know, sort of later in your investing journey. But as you say, we've been in, I think a lot of people call it this, you know, the everything bubble.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's gone on for a long time. So I must admit, for me, the attractions of fixed income haven't been there for...
Yes, I haven't considered it at all.
For a long time. Long time. You know, we had a little... And actually, for retail investors, private investors, not the easiest thing to access, you know.
We'll come on to that in a moment, because there are actually ways of doing it, but I think just to underline to investors, I mean, one of the sort of the number one rule for a Warren Buffett when it comes to investing is don't lose your money. And number two rule is basically don't forget the first rule. So bonds fit that, traditionally have fitted that camp in terms of, you know, you're not, it's wealth preservation. And if we both are right, and we've got sort of like elevated interest rates at the moment, then when they do start reducing them, say in 2024, 2025, because yields and prices work inversely, then we should see, some capital gains actually in certain bonds as well. So it's definitely an area to have a look at in sort of like diversification. Now,
I think if you can buy a bond close to par, you know, yeah, then you're great. You're not going to lose money. And if you get a nice yield out of that at the same time, that's you know, there or thereabouts in terms of the sort of inflation. You know, you're the sort of longer term inflation picture, then you're okay. But you know, it's difficult. If you're an equities investor, it's always, you've got to think about it a bit more. You know, the same rules don't necessarily apply. Duration matters.
Oh, hugely.
You know, which is something I don't think is a natural thing for equity investors to think about.
Okay, well let's just answer that first question you had in terms of where to buy. I mean, if you go to Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell, I mean, basically they offer them, you know, particularly if it's gilts or reasonably liquid corporate bonds, you can just go onto those platforms and trade them like any other stocks and shares. But most bonds, as I understand it, you're going to basically need to give them a ring, and they're going to have to try and place, because the liquidity is quite low, I think, in certain areas. So when it comes to sort of like, you know, where to go, what would be a strategy for sort of fixed income, for sort of like, you know, if it was your own sort of money, your own sort of portfolio, if you wanted to sort of get into it? I know I've got mine, but what was yours?
Yeah, I mean, again, like I said, fixed income is not something that I actively manage in my portfolio. You know, I've got pensions that are managed on my behalf, and they have a bond component. And I'm happy with that, you know, because again, it's one of those areas, like I say, there are many moving parts in this market. You know, the duration of bonds, the types of bonds that you can buy.
Yeah, fixed and floating. You've got indexed. You've got basically just normal nominal yield. You've got different currencies you can go into.
Yeah, indeed. So, absolutely. Different currencies, different regions, you know, the sort of your covenant.
Investment grades you've got.
Precisely. So I mean, you know, we over the years, I mean, you know, when I was editing the IC, we saw the arrival of the order book for retail bonds on the LSE.
That's still there.
Still there, but it didn't really take off in quite the way I think they'd anticipated. And you had some things go there, which, you know, go through that, which didn't really, you know, live up to their promise.
I think wasps.
Indeed. I wasn't going to name any names. But yeah, wasps. That was one of them.
But went bust.
You know, you had these things called mini bonds, which appeared, you know, roughly the same time. And what they were was essentially, you know, trying to do the same thing as the order book for retail bonds, but essentially without any of the sort of regulatory stringency behind them. They killed that market stone dead. And again, a lot of those things, you know, have not survived the course. Yeah. So a lot of the things were offered to income hungry investors, and that is generally why you would buy fixed income, is because you're looking for income.
I would say is, when, you know, I'm a classic equity guy, but I have bought bonds in the past, and I would say to most investors, if they were in my position, is to keep it simple. And if you just basically want effectively a bit of portfolio ballast, 60-40 portfolio, etc. And you just want to basically give yourself some diversification and traditionally non-correlated, you know, sort of like movements compared to your equity portfolio. Then if you want to basically and keep it cheap, just buy short duration UK gilts. You can get 4.1% on a 6 month, or go, you know, 2 year, and you can get 4.4% on it. You've got very little currency risk, no default risk, etc. And if you hold to maturity, then that's the yield you're going to get, and for that over 2 year period. And it's going to go nowhere in terms of, you know, but you're not going to lose your money and you're going to get a bit of extra income. It's better than putting it into the bank. And the transaction costs are pretty keen. So that the advantage of those when you go into gilt or you go into very large sort of corporate bonds.
Very high quality corporate bonds.
It is, yeah. You go into top quality.
A grade.
It is, yeah. You go into A grade, basically investment grade, etc.
Yeah.
And on that retail bond, I mean, there's plenty you can have a look at. You know, you can sort of like go Aviva, Rolls Royce, Barclays, BT, Vodafone, Citigroup, all FTSE 100 companies, and they'll pay you 5% plus largely. If you want, you know, have a look at it. They're liquid. The dealing costs are pretty cheap. And if you hold to maturity, you know, it's easy. Now, that's where I would stop myself in terms of keeping it simple, because you can get your head around the companies, the balance sheets, the prospectus that you need to look through to see what they are, because these tend to be unsecured, but obviously attached to it. And then basically anything else more esoteric in terms of high yield or overseas or, you know, floating or, you know, sort of like subordinated and all this sort of stuff, just leave that to the experts. And if you 100%. Want to go, if you want to go into that, and I wouldn't go into that anyway, simply because that wouldn't be in my portfolio. I've got enough risk in my equity portfolio. I'd only be going into bonds basically in the best of class just to keep it, give it some, you know, some ballast. So it's effectively like near cash essentially. So I wouldn't even go into those areas. But I have picked through a couple of higher risk sort of like retail bonds if people want to have a look at. There is sort of Paragon Banking, which is a buy-to-let business, which is a 6% yield. And then there is Metro Bank, which is about a 250 million market cap company, but it's got a pretty weak balance sheet in terms of, you know, sort of bank process. And that one gives you 11%. Now, I personally wouldn't go to those, but you can, if you slid your rule over those companies and you're happy with it on an equity base, you can almost get equity returns through the bonds with greater protection further up the corporate structure. So there are opportunities, but that gives you equity risk essentially, or slightly less than equity risk, and very good returns. But I would just personally, anything which gives you racy returns on a bond, I would run away from it, because that wouldn't be, for me personally, what I would be trying to do anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a commonly used description for those sort of bonds.
Well, I know it's junk, that's for sure. they don't allow you to sleep soundly at night, that's for sure.
No. I agree with you entirely. You know, if you want to go into, you know, esoteric bonds, use it. There are plenty of bond funds out there with managers who know how, you know, all the moving parts of this. That's where you should go for it. I mean, you talk about bonds being uncorrelated. That's been part of the problem we've had, you know, for some time in the sort of ZERP world, is that, you know, they haven't been uncorrelated.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Equities and bonds were going through the roof at the same time. So yeah, you couldn't buy those bonds at prices that didn't guarantee that your capital would be protected. I think we've come back to a more normal world, and therefore they can do the role in your portfolio that they were always meant to do. But it hasn't been that way for a long time.
Yeah, and a good tip actually for investors, if you're looking at a company that has both, you know, listed equity, stocks and shares, and listed debt, have a look at the price of the bond that's trade to give you an indication of what the credit standing is. Because, I mean, just to give you an absolute sort of like nutty environment or nutty scenario, which is currently, you know, happening in the world, that meme stock Bed Bath & Beyond, which is basically indicated it's going to file for, you know, sort of bankruptcy, zoomed up this week on the back of hopes that it might get some money out. But its bonds trade at 4 cents in the dollar. So it says everything, in that there's a lot of people out there who've got no idea about basically looking at a company's balance sheet and what the credit rating is. That equity is going to get totally wiped out unless there's a miracle. And you could just see that if you looked at the price of the traded bond. And I would encourage investors to always do that, because it's a real tell, actually, about how bond investors view that, the longevity of that company.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, like I said, you know, the bond market is always said, you know, and you know, I say this as an equity guy, should be a bit smarter than the equities market.
I think it's important, though. Exactly, and I think what we've just come through in 2022 with interest rates going up, it's important that investors do get their head around the bond market, what that means, and what's it saying. What it means to the cost of capital, you know, and now money is not free as everybody. So we can always learn a lot more on in fixed income. Not about it. Anyway, let's move something a bit more racy. Let's go for the sort of tech sector. And certainly we've had an absolute deluge of tech results, particularly out in the States. We've had Meta overnight. We've had Tesla, Microsoft. We've had the chip guys, Intel and AMD. What's your sort of like takeaway so far, rather than Wagamama being a takeaway? What's your takeaway from the route for the earnings?
I mean, it's kind of not pretty.
Yeah,
I think not especially pretty. You know, we're not seeing any strength in the sector in terms of the.
But the share prices have rocketed.
Yeah, but is that more to do with Jay Powell than
the
performance of the companies themselves?
Yeah,
you know what we are seeing, as I alluded to earlier, across the sector, is big layoffs. You know, there's been a big sell-off across the sector, but you know, it's not left them at necessarily cheap valuations across the board. Mm. You know, the things like the chip market is, I mean, it's a mess.
It's gone up a lot, though. Actually, it's amazing. I know Intel hasn't, but you know, I mean, you look at people like Infineon, who I used to own, and it's up like 20-25% in January. You've got Tesla up over 70-80%. You've had a double bagger on Facebook since its lows. I mean, it went up by 18% last night.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, the sector had been sort of written off. Entirely, and you know, I mean, it's sort of balancing how much of that is the possibility that, you know, that the Fed rate cycle is going to reverse. They're going to have to pivot. I think is the big hope for equity markets and tech investors in particular at the moment, and how much of that is you know, an improving business performance, and I think it's the former.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's really important that investors distinguish between cyclical factors, if they're driven by the cyclical side, and the pandemic, if they've been pushed up, compared to something more secular growth. And I think you've got to be really clear about what's going to drive, you know, the business going forward. Because as you rightly say, you know, over the last sort of like years, we've had that huge pull forward of the pandemic, which obviously, you know, rocketed PC sales and chip sales and also sales of all units of smartphones and stuff like that. Mm. And we're starting now to see softness right across the patch, even in places like, you know, cloud. And it's getting crowded in places like cybersecurity as well. There's so many, everybody's doing cybersecurity now.
Well, I mean, you know, so again, it's really difficult to distinguish between the secular growth aspects of the sector and its cyclicality. Actually, I think what happened was, you know, cheap money and then the pandemic made people forget that technology is a cyclical industry.
Mm. Yes.
You know, businesses,
yes,
which drive a huge amount of the spend. In the tech sector, but also, you know, consumers who obviously go through the ups and downs of, you know, job security and such and like, you know, it's an industry that has its ups and downs. You know, you look at something like Facebook, Meta, Google, they are massively dependent upon advertising. So when you get economic weakness, you're going to see weakness in their profitability. I mean, Facebook's numbers were pretty horrible when you compare them to a year earlier. Maybe not as horrible as people thought, but certainly this is not a business that is immune to the ups and downs of the economy. As you just mentioned, you know, and we heard this during the pandemic. It was even in the middle of the pandemic. It was, I think, Microsoft's chief exec, Satya Nadella, said, you know, we've seen 2 years worth of digital transformation in 2 months.
Mm.
And, you know, and people are like, okay, that's fine. We'll ignore that. We'll just carry on buying these shares, and as though you know. That trajectory is the trajectory forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the warnings were there. It's a cyclical industry like any other. Yes, there are secular trends behind it, But you know, its earnings will fluctuate, will oscillate with the cycle. So yeah, I like tech. You know, these are great companies. They are changing the world. That tech is finding its way into all sorts of other industries to make them more efficient. But it happens at a sort of natural pace, not the accelerated pace that we'd come to expect during the pandemic. And as you know, you talked about, you know, meme stocks, you know, stocks. Yes. You know, a lot of cheap, free, you know, stimulus money went into the sector on the basis that it was a one-way bet.
Mm.
Well, it hasn't been a one-way bet. And now I think, you know, I look at the sort of a 20% bounce in a week or whatever it might be. And, you know, is this the idea that we're just going to go back to where we were before? And it just seems like, you know, magical thinking to me.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems like the magic money tree. That's for sure. A bit like Liz Truss. So just in terms of sort of like, you know, where choosing the right spots in technology, what would you look for where we do have that secular growth? Is it sort of like your EVs, your sort of like, you know, your cloud is still obviously growing. You've got automation, you've got generative AI, which is your chat GPT, you know, what areas was sort of like attractive?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you go for core tech. AI is quite interesting. I mean, you know, I've been playing around with chat GPT. Who hasn't? I mean, it's a mimic machine. Really, yeah. is what it is. You know, it's clever, but it's not intelligent. You know, I really don't think so.
It's not like a bond investor.
No, not definitely not like a bond investor. You know, ask ChatGPT.
Put that in, shouldn't we?
Ask ChatGPT what it thinks of the bond market.
Yeah, exactly. We should put it there. Which bonds would you buy?
Well, it can only tell you what bonds it would have bought in 2020 because its data set stops, which is part of the problem. You know, again, a lot of the problem with this with AI technology, just like cloud or you know, crypto, is that, you know, it's hugely energy intensive as well. So, you know, these technologies have a carbon footprint, and you know, we forget about that. You know, you know, e-commerce. You know, I've always liked Amazon as a conceptually as a company, but in, you know, in terms of, I don't like it. Okay, in the sense that I actually quite like having some shops that I can go to, and it would be really nice if they were here for a little bit longer. But you know, the reality is that e-commerce is a secular trend. But I would like to think that they're the kind of companies you buy. And so Amazon was, you know, during the dot-com crash, you know, that got sold off with everything, and then, you know, there was something real to it. I think you should treat them like any other investment. You know, and actually, I spoke to a really interesting guy the other day, a guy called Ian Lance, who's a manager at a value investor called Temple Bar. You know, and as he pointed out, you know, the last, I mean, let's call it 13 years since the great financial crisis has been unusual in investing terms. If you look over the long term, you know, the majority of stock market gains have come from value investing, not growth investing. So if I can buy anything, and I include tech with that at reasonable ratings, then that's what I'm going to buy.
You could have bought Facebook actually, sort of like 6 months ago at a reasonable rating, because I remember chatting about it, and it was on 11 times PE or 10 times PE, and it's a bit more expensive now, double the price.
But I think it's a dog.
I was just doing the numbers, and I'll put it up onto the video. But even though at $180 per share, it's trading on a forward PE of 13, and you know, I mean, I got a valuation just doing a rough of 210. So there is 17% upside, but I'm with you.
Maybe. I don't know, because, you know, I mean, the reason that Facebook got thumped, I keep calling it Facebook, Meta, is because of the metaverse. It's because it went off on this weird tangent.
Zuckerberg's
weird tangent, this obsession with this you know, this virtual reality world. And, you know, people didn't like it. He was talking about spending $10 billion a year on building something that there was no real clarity that the world actually wanted or needed, and maybe you know, VR is going to be there in the future, but you know, it was a whim that of his that essentially destroyed the value in that company.
He's got religion now, though.
Oh, has he?
Well, it looks as though, from what he said yesterday, I mean, last night he was saying he's basically cutting the purse strings on quite a lot of the capex. Didn't say meta. In fact, I think in the conference call, he didn't even mention the metaverse. So it was all about he's always cutting headcount and costs and restructuring and even a $40 billion stock buyback.
Yeah, and this is really quite interesting. I was reading Terry Smith, the famous fund manager of FundSmith. You know, and I think his observation of tech, and he owned Meta, and I actually wrote a piece some time ago, basically saying, you know, I think you're wrong, Terry. I think, you know,
but he loved that. Meta's,
well, he didn't read it probably, but I was right, and Terry was wrong. But you know, his point about the tech industry is that cheap money has driven strange behaviors across the industry, and you know, whimsical investment plans in technologies that may or may not be successful 20 years in the future is one of the side effects of a long era of incredibly cheap capital. And you know, the tech industry, by the very nature of what that industry is obviously the most susceptible industry to these kind of. You know, I guess you could call it psychological, you know, psychological failures. Mm. You know, I don't know if you've ever happened to see in any of the TikTok videos of like, you know, tech industry staff explaining their day at work.
Right.
I'd like a day at work like that. It seems to involve sitting around in a canteen and doing very little else, eating free food. These businesses have been bloated. And probably because there was no shortage of money kept flowing into them. And what we're seeing now, and as Terry Smith alludes, it's a silver lining because, you know, they will, and I quote, they'll stop behaving as though money is free and halt some of the less promising projects outside of their core businesses. Yeah. That makes technology quite interesting. I think there's further to run in that process, but I want to see them be the businesses that, you know, cash generative, the businesses that they should be. And yeah, okay, moonshots, fine, but you know, I'll invest in them when they're approaching value territory, and I don't think they're there yet.
Yeah, I think you're right. And when now they're starting to get a bit more capital discipline, it's a long process, but hopefully it will sort of make them into much stronger businesses. I mean,
exactly, just
to reinforce exactly what you said 2 years ago, when we just had sort of like, you know, money pushed into the system, huge amounts of fiscal and monetary stimulus. What the most common valuation metric for these type of businesses wasn't even EV sales; it was EV TAM. It was basically looking at this total addressable market and valuing it as a percentage. And I was thinking, what?
Yeah.
How does that one work?
You know, you've been around as long as I have, Paul. And, you know, maybe. You've got less gray hair. But, you know, I started in the city on the eve of the dot-com collapse, you know, pretty much then. And, you know, again, it was, you know, I remember it. Eyeballs were a valuation metric.
Yes.
Know? And I've never been able to shake the fact that that all ended in tears. And it felt like the same thing was happening. So you know, I go back to like, I think and I hope that the environment has changed for the better, in that we will focus more on valuation and proper valuation techniques and you know, real analysis of cash flows, not into infinity where they can barely be understood, but you know, in a reasonably, you know, short time frame. So tech's long duration, I think we need to perhaps look at it in a shorter duration,
yeah,
and value it accordingly, and just get back to basics.
Are there any stock areas which you're interested in on your sort of like your watch list at all for sort of like, you know, tech stocks which have reached that value territory yet?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I do like the sort of, you know, I do like big tech. You know, some of the real sort of moaty stuff, you know, where you've got industries where this stuff is the sort of glue that holds an industry together. So I mean, you know, things like Adobe and AutoDesk that
do, yeah, okay,
you
know, they're class acts, you know, they're just not cheap, are they? They're winners. They're basically category killers.
Yeah, so you know, anything sort of CAD, you know, that yeah, I mean, AutoDesk and CAD category killers. That's exactly the way to describe it. What's AutoDesk? 33 times forecast earnings.
Yeah, I know. And it's about 10 times sales. I'll tell you, actually, and one I do own, which is effectively in that build tech space with AutoDesk, is Alico, and it's a small company, and it's struggled growing because it's obviously, you know, got some big competitors, but it's moving into the SaaS, and it's making a rapid transition on that, and it trades on just less than 2x sales. So that's an interesting one that I've held it for. I think I first bought in 2015, so it's been a long sort of tour, and I've not sold any. So that'd be one that I think people might want to have a look, you know, sort of at.
Yeah.
Any others?
I struggle. I mean, I had a really good chat with the guy, with Tim Levine, his manager, an investment trust called Augmented FinTech the other day. And you know, if you actually, you know, if you want to get tech cheap, then buy it through trusts because they are trading on pretty chunky discounts at the moment. Now, some of them, your fee structures are not great, but actually in the sort of private asset space, you know, Augmented FinTech is trading. I mean, when I last looked, it was a 30% discount. You know, I like FinTech. You know, I think this is a market where, you know, financial services industry is ripe for disruption. It's been very slow to adopt, you know, modern tech, you know, wealth management, you know, banking. I mean, look at Metro Bank. We mentioned it earlier. You know, I mean, instead of a real challenger coming along in the banking space and going, you know, we're going to really disrupt this through you know, technology, they've gone, we're going to disrupt the market by opening branches. which you know, it was mad.
It makes me worry that.
you know, so actually, I like, you know, I actually use Starling as a banking service. Absolutely fantastic. You know, companies like Stripe, which are massively disrupting the payment space, a lot of them in private hands. So I think a lot of the tech that I like and that you can buy relatively inexpensively now are in private hands.
Ones you can buy, which I own actually, in that fintech space, are the Forex, you know, international e-payments guys, are Equals and Argentex.
Yeah.
They're knocking the ball out of the park in terms of like for likes. They're both going to do over 20%. You know, sort of like year on year this in 2023, and they did a lot more last year as well with increasing operating leverage. So that's definitely worth
it. Yeah, I tell you, I do like, I'm speaking to them tomorrow, actually, it's Fintel.
Yeah, they're great. You agreed, Quality Act.
It's a great company, and I really don't understand why they don't get more attention. You know,
particularly on the valuation, because Euro money last year got taken out at 21x EBITDA. And I haven't run the slider all over Fintel recently, but I bet it trades at about 10 or 11 times, almost like half the valuation.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember which broker said it. I think it might be FinCap, but I might be wrong. But they say, you know, it's a digital business trading at an analog valuation.
Yeah, it's true.
And actually, I think it's true. And I think, well, you know, when you look at it, what it's doing is disrupting, you know, asset management. It's bringing data to an industry which hasn't really been driven by data before. You know, it's offering services to consumers that improve investment outcomes. It's making the whole process of being an investment advisor, you know, much more painless. And there is so much paperwork and regulation to deal with in that industry that actually is, again, as I say, it's ripe for technology. So yeah, Fintel, it's on my watch list. I haven't bought it yet.
Yeah. I'm
struggling to see how that share those shares get a breakout. But
somebody'll take them out. That's how they get a breakout.
I think you might be right.
Tomo Bravo will be basically knocking on the door, wanting to do a roll up, or some private equity guy who's got a, you know, sort of like that sort of perspective. Now, two others actually in that space, is one of them is Active Ops, which I own, which is basically does automation software to improve all the back office operations of banks and the insurance guys. And that one's, it's sort of complex cases like know your customer and onboarding people, onboarding clients and stuff like that. And again, that one's growing. It's just reached EBITDA break even, moving into profitability. It came as an IPO and has been sort of sold off. And that one's, you know, doing, it's starting to move up. So that's certainly something that people should have a look at, because it just saves the banks and the insurers massive amounts of you know, money in terms of improved productivity.
It's a totally similar proposition. It's exactly the same approach, just in a slightly different industry.
Yeah, and the final one I own, which again is in that, is serves all the corporate sort of hedge funds and big merchant banks around. 19 of the 20 world's largest merchant banks is FD Technology, which again I own, and they've got three divisions. But the real crown jewel is the KX Insights business, which basically does real-time data, mass data gathering. They've got it from all the algorithms that have come from the you know, the hedge funds guys to do instantaneous decision making, and they put the AI on top, and now they're using it outside of the capital markets. They're also putting it into IoT and manufacturing and all this sort of stuff, where and into the sort of like the hybrid cloud as well, and that it's been adopted by Microsoft. So there's plenty of, there's actually still quite a lot of really good tech which is in the valuation territory. But I think the big cap guys, because they've come down, then people now, you need another swoon down before they become really sort of like, you know, dead cert cheap, don't you?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, you know, of the big boys, you know, I mean, you just mentioned Microsoft. Mm. Microsoft are, you know, they're invested in OpenAI, you know, ChatGPT, looking to up their stake. You know, they took a big stake in the London Stock Exchange.
Mm.
Quite recently, so you know, I think Microsoft is a really interesting company.
They're not cheap,
27 times forward earnings.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was looking at as well.
So not cheap. I agree. There has to be, to my mind, another leg down. I think investors get a bit carried away with the Fed rather than reality. Although, you know, is the Fed reality? I don't know. It's weird, you know, strange world that we live in these days, post truth or whatever you want to call it. But you know, Microsoft, and again, this goes back to the conversation I had with Temple Bar, Ian Lance, the other day. Now, Microsoft once was written off for dead, and you could buy those shares for next to nothing.
$18, I remember.
So that's, I mean, I don't think we're going to get back there, but that's the sort of when the big boys get written off for dead, that's when I look at it. And I say that, having just dismissed my Facebook out of hand.
So. Yeah, well, I remember Amazon. I remember Amazon at $12 in 2003. But coming back to Microsoft, I mean, my fair value for Microsoft is about 174, 175, and it's, which is 30% lower than where it currently is. And I'm with you, class company, but not cheap. Ones which I would say, you know, the value territory and have been for some time, but is moving to the cloud and seem to be doing a good job of it. Massive tech is Oracle, actually. Oracle, they've got quite a lot of debt. But, you know, I think they're trading at about sort of 5 or 6% less than, you know, sort of my fair value. And I think Alphabet and Google is still around about fair value as well. I don't think that's particularly racy. But you've got to get your head around digital advertising and regulatory problems with Google, because you've got basically the SEC and the regulators saying that they could strip out the that advertising programmatic advertising business from Google to stop it dominating the sector. So you do get a lot of regulatory risk in this area as well, because they're just so dominant.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that risk is sort of appears to have gone away a little bit at the moment, but it was all anyone was talking about, you know, a couple of years ago. The threat of government intervention in tech is probably one of the reasons why I like Meta least, because actually there is so much potential bad news hidden beneath the surface there in terms of what social media does and how, you know, how the impact it has on people and whether it should carry health warnings in the same way that tobacco does. You know, so I don't like it. In that sense, which is probably why I tend to avoid it. Interesting, you mentioned Oracle. I'm just looking at another old tech company here, Cisco.
Routers, basically. 50% is hardware and a 50% is software, isn't it?
14 times earnings.
But it hasn't grown for 20 years.
But why hasn't it grown? I guess the answer to that is because it had its business ripped away from it by cheap Chinese knockoffs.
Price deflation in the hardware business. It hasn't been able to sustain its margins largely.
But I do wonder whether that will reverse if you look at the world of, you know, switching and telecoms equipment. You know, China, Huawei did come in and
good point,
and really ripped that market apart. You know, and you saw lots of consolidation. You had some really great European companies in that space. You had a British company as well, Marconi, but you had Alcatel.
They went bust.
They did go bust, but that's because they got undercut on the contract.
It was because of the CEO John Mayo ran the business off the cliff.
But great technology. You had Alcatel, you had Nokia, Nokia Siemens, you know, you had Ericsson in the space.
Norto went bust.
Rortel went bust too. But this industry is going to change. You know, we know that the geopolitics of it have actually changed the industry. So maybe the old big telco equipment guys are worth a look. Cisco on 14 times, got to be worth a look.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. And it would be remiss of me not to sort of like, you know, end on the biggest company in the world and the biggest tech company, Apple. Now, obviously, it's got a huge sort of like, you know, defensive moat. Warren Buffett loves it as a value play. It trades on roughly 23, 24 times PE going forward. EPS growth is about 3 or 4%. So your PEG ratio is enormous. What's your view on Apple? Is this a value play or value trap? Have you got an iPhone?
I do. It's an old one. I tried to buy a new one yesterday. That is a long story that we today. That was more a failure on the part of EE and their payment system.
Okay, right. Gotcha.
But anyway, else, but I was gonna upgrade to an iPhone 14.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, I think that it has such cachet with its customers. You know, it's the ecosystem. So, you know, once you're in Apple, you're not really going to shift it.
No, it's painful to move out.
Massively painful. Whether it can sell phones at that price, you know, forever, whether it can keep driving the upgrades, I don't know. But it's an interesting company. It always seems to have a trick up its sleeve. You know, there always seems to be something that sort of helps it shift through the gears again. I mean, I do worry about China. You know, for all companies that are selling tech into China, Apple, Tesla, you know, whoever else it might be, would I be buying it at 24 times earnings? What's the market cap now?
2.3 trillion.
Yeah, probably doesn't look like value to me. Yeah,
they're like an iPhone.
No. Is it going to go anywhere? Is it going to disappear? No. Is it going to get taken out? No. So, you know, if it got cheaper, would I consider buying it? I think I would.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the same applies to the sector as a whole here. At these prices, there's still a lot of expectation baked into it, even though we can expect, because we know it's cyclical, you know, for growth to moderate. So I just think the sector's too expensive.
Yeah, and I would say, out of all the classic sort of FANG stocks, to me, Apple has actually reached X growth. I don't think, because it's so dependent on iPhones. I know services is a big part, and they're thinking about putting the VR headset and all this sort of stuff. But because effectively buying that hardware is so core to the actual whole proposition, I suspect they'll be treading water on EPS. It'll be going up with inflation for the next 5 or 6 years. And if I'm correct on that, then yes, it's still going to be a great moat and a great cash generator, but it's going to migrate to 15 times PE or a market multiple of 16 times. And given it's on 23, I mean, all I would say is that I think this is at least 30, 40% overvalued to me, given the long, if I'm right in terms of the growth, whereas most of the other ones, I can see Microsoft growing faster. I can see Meta, well, obviously, you know, Salesforce.com, Amazon, you know, and Google have all got secular growth tailwinds. But unless they produce a new world-beating product, I think they're actually going to struggle, actually.
Yeah, well, there was talk of a car at one point, wasn't there?
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah, well, you never know. And a telly.
You never know. But, you know, what is it trying to do? I mean, yeah, it has its ecosystem, but, you know, Apple Music, well, you know, you're up against Spotify, which has never made a penny in its history. And you know, no matter how fast it grows, it can't seem to make any money. You know, Apple TV, well, you're up against Netflix, Disney, and, you know, whoever else. You know, everything's moving into, which was the benefit, with the advantage it had in the first place. You know, media was what grew that company. The fact that you could do things on your phone you couldn't do before. It's just got so much competition from all angles, apart from in hardware.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the services side of things it would need to grow, and I don't see what it's got to do that.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much, John, and look forward to seeing you down Wagamama sometime.
Yeah, well, yeah. I must admit, I won't be hurrying back.
And next month, we'll select two more sectors. So thanks again, John, and look forward in touching base.
Cheers, Paul. Speak soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.